After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Hey everyone, I'm back and I am with Mark Lesser, and we've been waiting for this holy day for about a year and a half, right, Mark? Welcome.
Thank you, Rob. It feels like indeed a holy day.
Yeah. Oh my.
Mark, but every day is a holy day. Yeah.
The last time we were together, we were doing kirtan, I believe. Mark, for those of you who don't know, Mark is a very prolific writer, number one. I get all your newsletters, and they're absolutely marvelous. And in fact, I picked a couple of things up out of them that we can chat about. But I know Mark through Search Inside Yourself, which was that started at Google?
Yes.
Yeah.
Started at Google. 2006 I got a call from a Google engineer saying, "Hey, we want to start this mindfulness meditation program in Google. Are you interested?" And of course it was, "Oh, and by the way, there's no budget." That was the...
Oh, yeah. The by the way. Yeah. By the way. Oh, boy. So that launched a whole... yourself into quite a wonderful career teaching, and
it was a marvelous experience. I learned and grew so much. Nothing like teaching mindfulness and meditation to Google engineers to get one's game in better shape. I had done lots and lots of meditation, but I hadn't really taught it and especially taught it in a secular environment.
Mm. All right, well, let's get to where, because that's the other thing I do know about you from our chat. And that's your deep embedding in the Zen tradition. And so, but let's talk about, you had proclivities that pushed you over into that tradition. And what were those, what were little switches that went off when you were much younger and directed you there?
Yeah, many switches. One prominent one was reading Abraham Maslow, Toward a Psychology of Being.
Wow.
You know, people think of Maslow as being the hierarchy of needs guy, but actually what I always thought was his real contribution was studying people that were highly evolved in some way, people that were more free and freer in their emotions and felt more deeply. And reading that book when I was a freshman at Rutgers, I recognized that was not me, and in fact it drove home just how asleep and not free I felt in my world, and I wondered, like, wow, what this makes I think I need to do something about my own asleepness. And that somehow that awakened some passion in me around, you know, self-discovery, and which led me to meditation practice and led me to Zen practice, which is something really resonant about that particular way of practicing and growing.
For those of you who are not that familiar with Zen practice, it is rather rigorous, to say the very least. And I always kid around with, I'm friendly with Roshi Joe in Halifax, who's done a bunch of retreats with Ram Dass that we did before he left in Maui for about 15 years. And I always say, yeah, you know, you've been doing this for eons to get, I mean, you're the epitome of disciplined practice, although she's a lot of fun, okay, if you know her. We are a bunch of sloppy bhaktis that have no discipline and don't know how to meditate, and we can chant Ram, that's about it. Of course, we've all been well steeped actually in Buddhist practice in our stay in India, but was psychedelics involved at all?
Oh, psychedelics, yes, they were definitely involved. When I was at Rutgers and not too long after I had read Toward a Psychology of Being, I had a professor who had been a colleague of Timothy Leary's.
Oh.
And we became close friends, and he was my source of government grade LSD.
Government?
Yeah, our government was doing and still are doing quite a bit of experimenting. And he was my mentor and actually kind of help create a context for taking psychedelics as a exploration, which and I would say I followed his mentorship about half the time, and the other half I was, you know, on the beach with my friends.
Yeah.
But it was definitely significant marker in this kind of wow. The experience of seeing how made up my experience is. And I think especially the experience of time, and which was both tremendously liberating and also I remember at the time a bit frightening. It's like, oh, this state, I don't know that I want to always be in this state, but is there any other time than now?
Yeah. Or you get to this point where there's a signpost: further exploration is necessary.
Right? Yes. Yeah. But that was part of the Zen discipline. Always was, you know, all those years of practice have been to rely on one's mind and not to rely on drugs.
That's one of the reasons why I ask, because I well know that. Well, not to rely on drugs, not to rely on external teachers, external whatever's, it's all what the experience is, right? Well, so mindfulness, boy, the ubiquity, whatever, of this word in our culture now is extraordinary. And it's unfortunately been strangled a little bit out of shape from where it comes. I mean, my rudder for this in my life, and he's been a good friend and a teacher, is Joseph Goldstein, who wrote that fabulous book, Mindfulness. But boy, has it strayed from the Satipatthana Sutras. And I know this is central. just give me some kind of feedback. Because, you know, as I kept thinking about us getting together, I'll be truthful. I'm so sick of mindfulness in a way. It was like, okay, this has to, I have to have this like a fresh consideration of mindfulness.
Well, great. You've come to the right person.
Okay, great. Hey, thank you.
To me, you know, mindfulness and even Zen, right? So, I mean, one of the things I love about Zen is that it has a sense of humor. It makes no qualms about negating itself and saying that, you know, you shouldn't smell of Zen, you know, someone the other day told me that their meditation practice really sucked. It was a terrible meditation practice. And I said, you know, in Zen, that would be considered bragging.
Yeah, yeah, right.
I think mindfulness and Zen are just simply, you know, code words, are just markers for what does it mean to be a full human being? How can you be a full, somewhat sane human being given this world that we live in? How might you aspire for that, and how might you practice for that? And to me, mindfulness is this, you know, this an enormous umbrella, you know, that includes, right, all of the kinds of the, maybe, you know, the Mick mindfulness that you were talking about, to the deepest, most, you know, most profound practices are all under this. It's a gigantic umbrella, but. Mm. But I think essentially, I've had various definitions of mindfulness, you know, or even of Zen, you know, like, it's like, how can you keep your heart open? How can you keep your heart open in any situation?
I did find, by the way, a definition which inspired me, and it was from you. The point of mindfulness is a practice is to cultivate a more alive, responsive, effective, and warm-hearted way of being within the world as it already exists and within the life you already live. And so the word that jumped out is warm-hearted. And I know His Holiness the Dalai Lama uses that quite a bit as well. So it immediately connects me to what the most important part of what we came back with in the day with Neem Karoli Baba, and that warm-heartedness really says it.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
the simplicity of that is a beautiful thing. Now, the other thing I liked, and this is again this from I believe we should talk about it. Seven Practices of a Mindful Leader, the book you put out last year, correct?
Yes.
That's really some great, great advisal in there. And I didn't get I should have asked you to send me the book, and I never did, but I went up and I found, you know, a way. There's always a way. But please do actually send me a book if you get a chance. So this quote from Suzuki Roshi, "You are perfect just as you are. And you can use a little improvement," mm-hmm. which I've heard many a time, always loved it. Mindfulness practice sees and embraces two worlds at the same time, the universal and the relative, or big mind, small mind. So let's talk about that. I think that goes a little bit with Ram Dass used to talk all the time about you can live on more than one plane of consciousness at the same time. And that, I think, is encompassed by big mind, small mind. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think in some way we humans are living on many planes of consciousness at the same time. And this is just, I think, a way to simplify it and help us see that how amazing our consciousness is. But in particular, I think, most of us were trained and led to believe that that there's only small mind and the world of small mind. And so I think that was, again, a little bit like Maslow's term, self-actualization, was a kind of pointing to something bigger than slogging through life, and the world of desires and the world of delusion. And then I think as Suzuki Roshi talks about it, as this, I think this something, he talks about it in many different ways. Sometimes he describes it as, beyond consciousness, this idea even of something beyond consciousness. But more often he talks about it as big mind, as your true nature, being who you in your kind of deepest, wisest part of yourself.
Yeah. And then the little guy I call mini me. I've been doing a lot of stuff with a friend of mine around this, the way that causes and conditions create this story, habitual patterns, neurotic tendencies, and this gigantic belief in thoughts. Mm-hmm. And that mini me, and that's a lot of what, as far as I'm concerned, that is what the spiritual path on the relative level is about. And moving into warm heartedness, mm-hmm. is the goal isn't to become the greatest meditator or mindfulness person in the world, which is what I meant when I first started talking about it, that latching onto it in that way, in our result-oriented kind of way, is probably counterproductive to what it can really do to help, So the times we live in right now, which are coming to a boiling point of some sort here with the election, everybody, this is just a couple of weeks before it, actually, of 2020, and the pandemic, which is rearing its head again in terms of not going away at all, going the opposite way. All the racial injustice, the economic suffering. I mean, it is quite, you doing the kind of work you are doing, this is a good job to have right now.
Spiritual teachers and therapists are thriving right now.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
No, I've been doing a lot of organizations, from small nonprofits to large corporations are like, we could use some help in how to stay more grounded and this uncertainty, right? Mm-hmm. All those things that you were describing, what connects them is this heightened sense of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? What's gonna, every time you go out of my house, am I gonna get ill?
Yeah.
Is our democracy gonna hold? How are we going to, as a nation, contend with these racial injustices and the levels of poverty and the number of the unemployment numbers are pretty staggering at the moment. So all of that is like, what does it mean to be warm-hearted? What does it mean to appreciate our lives? What does it mean to practice generosity, right? And without avoiding, ignoring, or suppressing all of these challenges.
Yeah. Well, one interesting thing you wrote about one of the newsletters: are you an optimist or a pessimist? And then, yeah, I really look at that, and coming from where I come from, I'm going to blame this all on my Jewish heritage, okay? And coming from also, I come from Montreal, So being Canadian, that's a whole other kind of twist as well. And I won't say that Canadians are fairly pessimistic people. Realistic is what I would say. But we are, as you say, all born with a certain set point about how we approach events and conditions, and we learn and develop filters and defense mechanisms. I put in mental models that shape how we see ourselves in relation. This is an important point, and maybe worthwhile to fleshing out more.
Yeah, I think it's again, particularly in this time of uncertainty, to notice how easily it is to go toward. To be, you know, I can as easily as anyone, you know, conjure mm-hmm. up horrible things happening around this election. But it's interesting to realize that I can just as easily conjure up fabulous things happening. And in truth, the future is just impossible to predict. It just is. Especially in these big items, but even, you know, I just got off a call just a moment ago in which this possibility arose for, like, oh, if I wanted to go in that direction, I could be the CEO of that company. Mm-hmm. And it's a, you know, having to do with death and dying. And just this, to allow, whether I choose to or not, just to let myself imagine playing out, oh, that could be really cool. That could be great. Just as, whoever thought that Barack Obama was going to be president. I mean, we forget how easily Trump has really been very special at making us forget that, who would have predicted either of those things happening? Mm-hmm. So, something about I think of cultivating the art of what's possible, and noticing our proclivity toward the negativity bias, and you know, it was one of my Google friends was a scientist who was very fond of saying that we humans are the descendants of the nervous apes. I think particularly the Jewish humans, but the Jewish Buddhist humans, but all we humans, you know, it's in our DNA to scan for threats. It's in our DNA to look for all the things that could go wrong, because it keeps us alive. It keeps us safe. And basically, this is, from an evolutionary perspective, the most important thing. So I think so much of mindfulness practice, spiritual practice, Zen practice, is how do we undo that? How do we work with that breeding for fear? Basically, for fear, for what can go wrong, for threats, and often we're not disappointed by all the things that can go wrong, and it's verified. I think it takes some practice, and also I think a great deal of support. I mean, this is I think the power of community is also feeling our deep. Warm-heartedness is warm-heartedness, you know, that we give and that we receive. And I think it's interesting to, like, I'm just so appreciating this conversation with you right now, just feeling your warm-heartedness,
that exchange is what's, I believe, will be the, saving grace of all of this, that gets expanded from person to person to person, enabling this kind of exchange and feeling.
I think we so underestimate the way that we are connected with each other, that again, it's like it's as a defense mechanism, it's easy to make ourselves separate and defend ourselves that, but this warm-heartedness of just like, again, both feeling and using our imaginations for what's possible in how we connect.
Yeah. You know, though, when people are pessimistic, and I'm speaking of myself, because like I'm the kind, you know who Larry David is? Larry,
oh, sure. Yeah, I'm a big fan.
Okay. So there's us big fans of Larry David, who is so horrible a person and so caustic and so self-involved and so always doing the wrong thing. There are people who won't, like, I tried to get Ram Dass to watch it. And he, a few minutes of it, this guy's horrible. How can you watch this? I'm like, okay, well, I like that whole, I guess the cynical thing is a fun thing. So yeah. Then that takes me to the pessimistic thing. People actually, they do piling on. I mean, Sharon loves this term, Sharon Salzberg, piling on. You get pessimistic about one thing and you build a castle. And when you're finished building, you kind of feel proud of it. And it's actually a habitual pattern that makes you feel good, which is why you don't ever give them up. I mean, and that's what mindfulness is about. Everybody out there, that's what it's about. So you have a clear picture of your motivations, of your habitual pattern, a clearer picture of your motivations, habitual patterns, neurotic tendencies, and you don't have to enjoin with them. You can see that, oh, this is what this is. Okay, I can leave it alone for a moment, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to me, you know, Larry David, and, you know, the show Seinfeld, it's all just great teachings in, you know, samsara and
very deep samsara.
But I think there's something actually useful about recognizing, you know, and then being able to laugh at all of the, you know, the nuances of our the suffering, of our pessimism, you know,
losing self-seriousness is highly important. Mm-hmm. And having a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. Without that, you're screwed for sure.
And it's interesting, maybe the opposite of warm-heartedness is manipulative.
Mm.
And Larry David, on Larry David's character, is just so manipulative, so, you know, scheming for advantage in some way.
Self.
So it's like
cherishing at the very.
If he were warm-hearted, it wouldn't be funny at all.
Yeah, right. Isn't that weird? That's weird, right there. That's right. Oh boy. Another thing, I know I love to talk about this, and you have, and it's we should talk a little bit about courage. And it does take courage to recognize and allow these reflections once you have them and you see the kind of self-interested motivation. The courage to actually face it is a big thing in mindfulness, as far as I'm concerned. I want to tell you a story. Okay, Mark. It's been told before many's a time, but you know what? It comes from Krishna Das. Mm-hmm. But it is so directly to the core in our experience, particularly because of the tradition of bhakti yoga that we come from and guru kripa, the grace of the guru. Krishna Das was in Mumbai with Maharaji and a couple of Indian people and Westerner, and he was staying at a hotel, and Maharaji used to come over and give darshan, and he'd sit on the bed and everything. Pretty lucky moment for Krishna Das. And all of a sudden, Maharaji sat up in the bed and he said, courage is a very important thing. So the Indian man, who had been a devotee forever, right, who was being with him on this trip, said, but Baba, the grace, this, it's all Guru's grace. There's nothing to do. And Maharaji turned back to Krishnas. Courage is a very important thing. I don't know if the word was important, it was very key. Okay. And Krishnas said, look, for the rest of my life, whenever I had trials and tribulations, which were of a, you know, which were very powerfully pulling me into them, I always had that, you know. And so it's the beauty of that and the realization that that is not hooked up with will. That is hooked up behind will, courage, in my mind. But I want to let you talk about it a little bit.
Well, of course, you know, the word courage comes from the word heart. And you know, and getting back to what you were saying about, you know, this word mindfulness, I think, you know, again, there's this whole spectrum, but I think you're now more, I think, at the, what I think of as the top of the spectrum of mindfulness when you start talking about courage, right? That this is, that this stuff is not, you know, it's not easy. And
it's not easy to look inside yourself, right? It's not easy to search inside yourself.
That's right. Facing oneself is not easy. Having real, authentic relationships, not easy. You know, aspiring and taking any kind of action that, you know, wanting to have positive influence, wanting to be the bodhisattva mind, the mind of I love these two core vows, you know, from Buddhist practice, right? Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. And delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. So these are both, I think, fine examples of aspiring to do what is impossible. And it takes courage to set out, even to imagine, even to think in that, you know, like to be able to set in that direction. And it's also very humbling because we're not going to save all beings nor get rid of all of our delusions, but courage says that, well, we have to try anyhow.
Yeah. And I think part of that trying is the practice of moving out of normal ego mind stuff and into what, I mean, Ram Dass had a great term, loving awareness, but into a place that's part of that, whatever we want to call it, that true mind, true self, soul, spiritual heart. I mean, the good thing is there's so many words for it. You know? Yeah.
Radical warm-heartedness.
Radical warm-heartedness. I like that. Yeah. That's good. But moving into that and from that place, being able to have the kind of stamina it takes to allow for things to just be, mm-hmm. just exist, mm-hmm. without wanting to severely change them. Mm-hmm. Like my dog suddenly thinking she should be part of this podcast. And her name is Maya, so it fits perfectly, right?
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Hello, Maya. Nice to see you.
Then we have, but what I love in this newsletter also is this quote, which I knew this quote. I hadn't heard it in a long time. It's from Trungpa, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, one of our most favorite teachers. The bad news is there's no parachute. The good news is there's no ground. So, but maybe you've got to explain that out a little bit more.
Yeah, I think that quote, I hadn't heard it until, you know, very recently, and it came up in the context of talking about the pandemic and the election and all these issues, right? That they bring up this sense of that, you know, of that we're falling and fear. They bring they ease this uncertainty and again all the things that could go wrong. What could go wrong is that you just jumped out of an airplane and there's no parachute. Like that, this is radical wrongness. This the other side of it is that everything we fear, it's temporary and it's made up. Temporary and made up, and that we actually have some choice about the story we tell about are we falling or are we flying? You know, one of the things I find myself so common with I get to work. I sometimes describe myself as a stealth Zen teacher working in the business world, and you know, something I find a lot, you know, with people in the work world, and this isn't just business people, this is all of us, right? That people describe that I'm slogging through my day, I'm slogging through my life, and I'm you know, if I'm in a coaching situation or mentoring situation, it's like, well, why not make some other choice? You know, what about dancing through your work or dancing through your life? Slogging sounds, not only does it sound boring, it's probably not good for you. It's probably bad for your heart and bad for your state of mind. Try flying, try dancing. And so to me, that's the other side of that. The good news is there is no reality in the way that we, and it points right to our limiting beliefs and our narratives and stories about the ground. Yeah. What is the ground after all?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's where the courage comes in, as you say in this article. Instead of moving towards that usual pattern that you know, and that can be just, I'm slogging through this shit, it's unbelievable. Can be just that. Mm-hmm. And you stop moving in that direction. Mm-hmm. And this goes back a little bit to pessimism and optimism, you know, and I'm working on that in myself, you know, of the silliness that I get into around pessimism, cynicism, and having fun with it, you know, boy, that's a lot of fun to think of stuff in that way. Yes. And yet there's a little bit of fooling oneself because that's a defense mechanism, basically. So, yeah.
And to this day, I have to say, and I have no problem describing my life as an utter failure, you know, despite, you know, books I've written or things I've done, I can just feel like, is this it? Like, is this like, mm-hmm. you know, and I can, with a little bit of work, describe myself as immensely successful and satisfied and realize that neither of those really, I mean, this is, I think the isner, there is no parachute is that, why get worked up or concerned about either of those narratives and just feel the miraculousness of being alive and my own breath and consciousness and body and your breath and consciousness.
Yeah. Fresh, feel freshness.
Freshness. Generosity, aliveness, appreciation.
And that happened, and that happens so easily, you know, like you and I doing this podcast, all these podcasts that I do, I basically am making friends with people because I don't get to spend time with them or I've never met them before or something like that. And that brings up the reality of freshness and interconnectivity and the way in which we really support each other. the way in which we know it's okay for each of us to have whatever fallacy we have going on, whatever perspective that we both know is okay, but we're human and we understand that as well, you know. Mm-hmm. There's one thing in this particular letter, Mark. You may have written this, and I'm not anywhere near a writer like you are, so you expressed it in a way that I would have liked to, and I need to read it because it is so right on. You say, "Lately, I feel as though I'm waking up from a deep sleep. There's a clear sense of something ending. Clear sense of something ending. At the same time, I don't have a clear feeling or vision of where this is leading, which is both painful and exhilarating. The awareness of my attitudes regarding race and coming to terms with my responsibility is a major catalyst for this waking up, for this transition. I'm beginning to see and feel how I've avoided my personal discomfort and cultural pain in this area. Some deeply held assumptions, personally and culturally, are being challenged. Many are being shed." That's so well spoken. As I say, I have been thinking these exact thoughts, and all I can say is I thank you for putting them on paper, okay? But is it, we are all going through this.
Yeah. No, I feel like I'm, you know, losing my innocence when it comes to race and diversity, and it's and seeing how important, integral it is to our, whether you call it spiritual growth or just, you know, again, coming back, just being a full human being is like facing this, you know, that how we were, the assumptions we made, the assumptions that we were taught, that making visible all of the things that have been invisible, at least to me, you know, have being a privileged white guy.
You talk about we all talk about letting go. I mean, Joseph Goldstein's big advice to a young man who was driving around in Maui when he went to do a retreat with us. He said, "Gee, maybe you could give me some words of advice, Joseph. I've been on the path a few years. You've been on it for decades. Esteemed Buddhist teacher that you are." And he just looked at him and he said, "Stop clinging." So we're all about letting go, right?
Yeah.
It's all about letting go. Talk about the usefulness of mindfulness and identifying that which needs to be let go of. Mm-hmm. And that which perhaps is okay to just say, yeah, you're human. There's a little funny tightrope, you know, wire act there.
It's one of my favorite paradoxes is, fight for change and accept what is.
Yeah, right.
You know, exactly. So it's like, yeah, and I think in a way, they both can be seen through the lens of letting go, right? So accepting what is letting go of wanting things to be different.
Yeah, that's number one on the list.
But I think the fighting for change is letting go of our limited, limiting beliefs and seeing the, not being too caught, letting go of being caught by events and being able to see systems more clearly. So like racism is the systemic racism that we swim in means, you know, letting go of our own limitations and not just seeing event after event, but seeing the underlying cause of these events. And, you know, and this is also, you know, Buddhism 101, you know, the second, you know, the second noble truth is like, what's the underlying cause of our suffering, of our discomfort, of our, what's the underlying cause of our essential kind of limitations that stop us from being warm-hearted, that stop us from being free, that stop us from being generous.
Yeah. So
shedding, you know, there's that, it's my favorite line from the, you know, I think of it as a Zen text, but it's a Buddhist text, the Heart Sutra, right? Without any hindrances, no fears exist. So it's like letting go of whatever gets in our way, whatever is limiting us, holding us back.
And that's
right. And I think this is, you know, more and more, this is my, I feel like my daily meditation practice is with each exhale, this sense of practicing, letting go, you know, again and again, you know. And
yeah. Relaxing. That just leads me to think about, we all need to relax a little bit. We are so wired right now. Mm-hmm. So I think people who can do any kind of meditative practice, even if it's just for a few minutes, I think focusing on just relaxing the body before you do anything and just really initiate some sense of calm and spaciousness is really important in these times. And the other thing, which you talk about as well, and we have been doing stuff online around for all these many months, resilience. And resilience is extraordinarily important. We just did a retreat at the end of August. Actually, we're just going to release it so people can download it. Wise hope. It's Roshi Halifax's thing about wise hope. Mm-hmm. The ability, it's cultivating, and we called it loving resilience. Because a lot of times people with resilience are, we're going to be resilient now, you know. It tightens it up. It's the opposite of what I just suggested in terms of ease and relaxation to allow spaciousness to happen. But yeah, from your point of view, resilience.
Yeah. Well, I also thought of, again, coming back to what one of the themes here is about courage and heart and warm-heartedness. Yeah. So warm-hearted resilience. And again, I think the two issues, you know, resilience by definition is how we, actually my current definition of resilience is how we transform a difficulty and work with change or accept change and impermanence, right? Because so much of resilience has to do with those two big buckets of things being difficult, which I always think of this. I don't know if you were ever a Simpsons fan, but there's a great,
well, I know them, yeah.
A great Homer Simpson line where Homer Simpson says, "Why does everything always have to be so hard?"
And yeah, right. That's so great.
So being able to transform how we work with difficulty and how we resist, seeing how we resist change. You know, I'm often joking that I'm forming a support group called Buddhists Against Change.
That's great. I love that.
Because I, you know, who likes change?
No,
you know?
It's awful. Like, change is just horrible.
Terrible.
And it's awful that it's the core of what life is. It's even worse that way.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. The other thing to... We're getting close to the end, but you talk about relationships and a prescription for us all in these times, to have more one-on-one, to have what we're doing right now, to have this kind of conversation with, don't need to be on a podcast, doesn't need to be for anything at all, where you can be open and vulnerable, which is the real beauty that can happen between two people. And for us, and I feel, I mean, it's not news, the Buddha, when he was asked by Ananda, well, what's the most important of the refuges? The Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha? And Buddha went, Sangha. And it's what we were taught. It's what we were initiated into when we were first in India with Neem Karoli Baba and Ram Dass. He went back the second time. And I don't mean in any purposeful, in any way you'd think somebody was doing anything, but the fact is we were just taken in to these families and the kind of unconditional love that they shared that we experienced, and the giving of food, the way food is in India is so important. That satsang, sangha, in these times, and of course it's difficult because we have to be socially distant. It's a cruncher, eh? All these things feeding in each other and creating more. But and as much as the internet has so much abuse. As much as it has abuse, it has beauty. But yeah. 100,000 beautiful visions, 100,000 horrible visions are there. And that's part of the acceptance. But the ability for us to have, I mean, online satsang, we have been doing a lot of that, mm-hmm. you know, and we have a Ram Dass Fellowship. By the way, any of you guys out there, if you want to get involved, go to ramdass.org and you'll maneuver over somehow to fellowship. And join it, and people, you'll get hooked up. But yeah, that's extremely important for well-being. And if we have to, and if it's just a Zoom life for now, okay, you know, this is.
Yeah, I'm amazed how potent it is. I now do meditation every morning, you know, with a large group of meditators.
Oh, you do? Oh, yeah, wonderful.
I'm sitting in the mornings with the San Francisco Zen Center community, and. And there's something about, now it does help, you know, that I know a lot of those people, but just being there even online, you know, with a group. And I was also thinking, similar to the story you told, there's I think of it as one of the oldest Buddhist dialogues where someone asked the historical Buddha, what is the most important thing in practice? And his response was good friends. Having good friends, and and it takes work and effort, even pre-pandemic, having real friends, you know, I think it's a crucial and cultivated art form, life form to. Mm. You know, because it takes time, it takes commitment, it means being vulnerable, it can be messy. But I think it's especially, I mean, it's one of the things that I loved about my years of living at the San Francisco Zen Center.
Oh, yeah.
These were unusual friendships. These weren't people that I chose to live with, but they were like, you know, Dharma friends that we were all practicing together and rubbing up against each other, you know, in working together and eating together. And there is something I think profoundly healthy about mm-hmm. friendships and community.
Yeah. Friendships developed around a like-mindedness about wanting to be free mm-hmm. of the stories that we are so convinced that is who we are, and the way that we support each other that way. I mean, the people that I was in India with back in the day when Ram Dass went back, as I said, the second time we joined him, people like Krishna Dass and Danny Goleman, you know, Larry Brilliant, all these people that we were together, there's a way in which in that we all had this tremendous desire to really know the truth. Now, and that's a philosophical thing. We were just drawn, that truth ends up being unconditional love, unconditional caring, sharing. What Ram Dass represents to most people who know about him, who've ever encountered him or read a book or anything, and that truth. Mm-hmm. And since that time, we may not see each other for a long, long time. And then that moment that we do, it's like nothing happened in that span of time, because we really did connect on that truth level. Mm-hmm. We didn't connect so much on our ego personality level, although we dealt with that, and that was good stuff too, right? As you said, mm-hmm. we're eating together, we're drinking together, and we're like jousting a little bit, right? And we used to joust just to get to Neem Karoli Baba. I mean, we were all lovey-dovey people, but people wanted to be, you know, close to that thing that was vibrating. Got to get, you know, I got to get near that. I'm going to elbow you so I can get near that. So that kind of a thing was going on as well. But the relationship and connectivity through the depth of this love that was being shared, is a lifetime. It just lasted a lifetime. So I count myself very fortunate. And you know, we do what we can these days to share that as much as possible and create environments where it can be shared. But we're human, and look what we've got, this collective karma going on here, don't we? Huh? It's just, oh boy.
It's quite, well, quite the contrast to the way you were just talking about, you know, your relationships and the warm-heartedness and courage, and in seeming contrast to the craziness of what's happening in our world right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there's, before we leave, I have to read this little poem you put in one of these newsletter. I think it's Anne Hillman. We look with uncertainty. It is. We look with uncertainty beyond the old choices for clear-cut answers to a softer, more permeable aliveness, which is every moment at the brink of death. For something new is being born in us if we but let it. We stand at a new doorway, awaiting that which comes, daring to be human creatures, vulnerable to the beauty of existence, learning to love. Who is she? This is, I don't. Oh, wait, no, I know Anne Hillman. Famous Anne Hillman, right? Mm-hmm. Poet.
Poet. Yeah, beautiful. Thank you for sharing that.
Oh no, I love that, Mark. I love that, and I love that we finally got together after all these months. Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. And everybody will have, you go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/mindrolling. You'll see the show notes, and we'll link you up to Mark's books and whatever else we might have been talking about here. Little Trogim Trumpa wouldn't be bad in these times, right? Spiritual Materialism. There's a good book. Meanwhile, go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and enjoy all of the great, great podcasters, teachers, thought leaders that we have there. And we shall see you next week. Again, thank you. Namaste, Mark.
Thank you.